Welcome back to Dating Games, a modern relationships podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps. I had the joy of seeing our guest debut show, Santok, in a 50-seat venue back in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2018. She's nodding, she remembers it, that's good. She promptly sold out her run and has been touring the world ever since, often incorporating three languages into her work, which fascinates me. She also hosts the Child Labour podcast with previous guest Stuart Goldsmith, and her name is Sindhuvi.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, I love romance. My whole life, when I was little, I wanted to know, who am I going to end up with? Who's going to date me? What kind of boys am I going to like? I was obsessed with this idea. And then, of course, no boys ever dated me for the longest time because I turned out to be 5'10 and very strange looking in India. And so I was like, oh, well, this has not gone the way I wanted. And I remember seeing When Harry Met Sally and thinking, oh, maybe if I lived abroad. So, of course, that was one reason to come abroad, was to get a date, move continents to get a date. So when I heard that you wanted me to be on your podcast and it was about dating and relationships, I was like, this is right up my street. I love this kind of stuff. I'm a big romantic, so I'm so excited.
I love that. I always appreciate your confidence because you wouldn't believe how many comedians talk about dating and relationships in their material all the time. And then they come to speak to me and they start off by telling me they don't have much experience.
Oh, I mean, I don't have much experience in the sense I didn't get dating as much as I wanted. I started very late. Like I told you, I was in my 20s, really.
Don't go back on it now. You've got all the experience.
No. I have. But I think experience is also what you make of it. Like for someone as obsessed with dating, being single was part of the experience. I mean, there was a point where I was single where I would behave so absurdly around boys I had a crush on. That these boys, I don't blame them for running in the opposite direction. I think they thought, what the hell is going on with her? Why is she so weird? And it's because I wanted them to date me. Because no one would date me for the longest time.
I had a bit of a trend like that in my teens, where a lot of the people that fancied me seemed to be the people that were not on my radar. And I think that's part of the reason that I would get really in my head around people I did like. And meanwhile, I'm coming across much better to my friends.
Yeah, but I used to check with boys that were my friends, said, do you fancy me? And they'd say, not really, but like, you're a great friend. And I'd be like, oh. I think I went through a phase from like 16 to 19 where I thought, I'm not going to be fancied. That was also why I was so keen to have an arranged marriage, because I thought, well, no one's going to pick me. Because I had Indian friends who were, you know, they had dates and they had boyfriends and they were getting married to them. Because marriage is a very big outcome at that time in India. You could date, but you had to get married. My mother didn't want me to date because she wanted to choose my husband, which is fine. I was like, yeah, go ahead. Pick someone. Pick someone who will like me. That was very much my motivation for being so gung-ho about having an arranged marriage in those days, you know, when all my friends were rebelling against it. And I was like, no, it's the only way I'm getting a date.
And I'm sure from what I've heard about your mum, she would have been only too keen.
Oh, no, mummy wanted me to have an arranged marriage completely. For mummy, marriage was all about, you know, the right family, all the things that arranged marriages across the globe have always been about, so that the couple should be happy, sort of okay, but it's the bigger picture. It's families marrying each other and so on and so forth. So I was like, yeah, fine. I don't really care. Just get me a date.
Which is interesting because I find the narrative around it so strange in this country, because a lot of people have a very poor perception of what that actually means. And a lot of the people...
Arranged marriages.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the people that are most against the idea of it are actually against forced marriage, which is something altogether different.
And I remember coming here at 21 and everyone thinking arranged marriages were forced. And I was like, why do all these people think that's what an arranged marriage is, you know? Arranged marriages are more like a kind of a blind date where you, both parties are going in with the idea that this could become a marriage. But I think the thing that's very different about arranged marriage, so let's leave forced aside.
Forced is just a terrible thing.
Let's just leave that aside for the moment. Mm-hmm. Arranged marriages, in the way in which mine would have been arranged, where I would meet a boy maybe 2-3 times, but then you would have to decide. In retrospect, what I realize about arranged marriages is they were part of a very special microclimate. So you needed girls who didn't have strong opinions on men. You needed girls who believed in family first and themselves second, which all sounds terribly unfeminist. But given that I was always around women who were doctors, policemen, surgeons, and they'd had arranged marriages, it's not anti-feminist. It's just for a culture to continue, you need people to buy into it. You know what I mean?
I think that's what a lot of it is. And the expectations are very different. And so...
Yeah, exactly.
Within...
And so I think...
Yeah, so actually within my family, being Irish, we have arranged marriages. But
yes,
we would never... Well, other than me, most of the family wouldn't ever refer to them in that way because it's seen as this further afield thing. And yet actually so many of my relatives have been introduced to people, and I have, you know, families where multiple cousins have been married into the same family. And, you know, some of it feels a bit, for me, like one cousin that married his, like, other cousin's ex. You know, there's sometimes where it gets a bit too complicated.
Yeah, but it's very clannish.
Yeah, but I can understand, you know, some of the motivation, and the expectations are different.
That you
go in, and it's a lot of it is about the context of the two families coming together. And actually, certain parts of Ireland, population-wise, there aren't that many options.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I think for me, arranged marriage is not a problem as long as the girl is okay with it. The boy always has more choice, and that I don't like. But if that's not the case, I never felt I would have to marry someone. I did feel there were a couple of boys along the way that mommy really liked. And I thought, oh, I'm going to have to really argue my case because I don't like these guys. But then I just went and told my dad. I'm like, I don't like them. He was like, okay. My mother was like, oh, you spoil her so much. But no one would have forced me. Absolutely not. They might have put subtle pressure on me.
Yeah, but then that's not a mile away from what we think of as like Western marriage. You know, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of expectation, particularly on women, that you need to be thinking about your wedding day from a crazy young age.
Yeah. And I also think arranged marriage is very different, very, very different to Western marriage ideas, because marriage in India is something... It's not about, even as a young person, you don't really think the person I lust after is the right life partner for me. You know that's bullshit. You see it in the movies, all Bollywood movies. You see that lust and life partnership don't go together.
Mm-hmm.
So very often I would have friends who would have a boyfriend, and my mother would say that's not going to work because the family values are different. And what she meant was their upbringing is different, which is relevant when you start having children and you fight about money and schooling and the value you put on schooling and the value you put on husband being home with the children or wife being home with her kids. Those are values. That's not magic. No matter how amazing the sex with a person is, it doesn't mean that's going to translate into values that will make a marriage and a family work. And now, if you say, well, we're not going to have a family, we're just two people, and we're not going to have kids, and we're going to have a partnership, sure, great. But there's still going to be issues that are going to come up. What if the woman gets a job that's much bigger deal than the husband's job? Is he the kind of guy? Which, let's be honest, these days we like to believe that that's just not an issue. But it can be an issue for either of them, you know? Things like those are values. And I'm not saying that there's no happy place where great sex and great values can come together. I'm just saying... Basing a marriage on romance and lust alone and expecting that to carry you is not something Indians grow up with, that idea, you know, and that's why we have a lot more harsh jokes about marriage, because we are fucking weathering that shit. I once said to my husband, I will torture you to death before I'll divorce you, just so you know. He was like, no, I'm experiencing that right now. Don't worry. You know, so I think, and I'm not saying that's good or bad. I think that there is the instances of divorce in Indian marriage. I welcome them because they're often predicated on women having more choice and being more economically free, which I think, yes. You know, my whole attitude to marriage has always been the day this doesn't work, I'm out. I'm out. I've literally walked it every single day. I take, maybe every week, I take a kind of a mark to market, as we used to call it in banking. You know, there's a mark to market. Is this something I want to be in? And if not, I'm out, because that's not how to live.
Mm. Okay, I like that. Yeah, I think there's a first point there. And we're going to come back to it, actually, because I'm fascinated in your mentality of wanting to win in marriage.
Oh, my God, it's so important. By the way, do you know anyone who says, yes, I want to lose? Nobody says that.
Yeah.
So everyone wants to win. They just don't want to own it.
And so what would you describe that as? What does it mean to win in a marriage to you?
So like small shit, I don't care. Like this morning, my husband and I were out. He got a coffee. I was doing something. He got a coffee and I didn't have time. And then I came out and I said, let's go get a coffee. And he was like, I have to go back. I have to go to work. And I was like, okay, fine. But big things are when you're standing in the kitchen with your spouse and they are literally asserting something, which if it was to go their way, it would mean that a number of things that you held very important and dear and especially how that would translate into how the next little bit of time was going to be spent was going to be upended, then you got to win that. You can't take that shit. No, 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 no. Especially when I know I'm right. I mean, what? Why am I giving points away when I know I'm right? Because so many times in the world, I'm wrong. Take it then. Why are you taking me when I'm right? I know I sound like a psychopath, and that's not what I mean. But like by winning, I mean, by winning, I mean, like when you're really with your partner, when you go head to head, if you could just show them that the way that you're suggesting the day goes or the weekend goes or the kids do this, it's the right way. And what's the problem? Get on board.
So I think that's how I would translate it, that you like to maintain power and authority.
I do, on the things I give a shit about. Mm-hmm. So there's some people who are very controlling. I'm not controlling. But on the shit I care about, it becomes a thing.
Yes.
There's lots of stuff I don't care about. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. I'm a Hindu, I'm a vegetarian, yes? And it's important to me religiously. But I married someone who's not a Hindu and certainly not vegetarian. So I never made it a deal with my children because I thought I can't, in honesty, have intercourse with someone who's a meat eater and then produced children and said, well, now you can't eat meat because there's something wrong with it. Bitch, you were screwing this guy. What are you talking about? Do you know what I mean? You were having sex with this man. What are you talking about? That to me is something that's unconscionable when people of different faiths get together and suddenly you want to raise your kid just in your faith. That doesn't work. So I've never made a deal about that ever.
Yeah.
What I have made a deal about is the children will never address people older than them by first name. It's a very big deal in India. I don't care if it's not your auntie. You will be calling her auntie. End of story. I don't give a shit. And so I don't want to hear this is the West and we don't not. Hello, this is not the West. This look at this. This is not the West. You guys, you're going to do it. So that's always been a line for me. You know, and it's either you call your friend's mom, Mrs. Hodder, or you call her Sandra auntie. You're not fucking calling her Sandra. And then when my husband and I have talked about it and he's like, no one here thinks it's a respect thing. I'm like, I don't give a shit. I think my ears burn. My children are calling grown-ups by first name.
I know what you mean. And also that's something where I don't see there being a bad side to that, right? I think people will take that and understand that it's respectful in the same way my parents encourage me to call people like my friend's parents, their role as a parent followed by their child's name. And
it's a sign of respect.
Yeah. And also, as somebody with a bad memory, much easier for me. So I don't mind that at all.
No, exactly. But I think it wasn't bad, but it was embarrassing for the children. They had to adjust to it, you know. And I was like, well, like, get adjusting. And then after a while, they didn't care. Because Denmark is famously non-hierarchical. And Danes will call their uncles by first name.
You know, for when they're older. Context for the listeners, your husband's Danish.
He is Danish. And that's all well and good. And I love so many things about Denmark. I'm a huge fan of Denmark. But my kids are not calling their uncles by name or even their friends' dads by name. And that's just that. So that's two different examples. I think people think, oh, Sindhu must have everything her way. No, the shit I care about, I like to have my way. For me, that's always the gauge. How much do I care about this?
But I think that is very fair, actually. And whilst I'm going to do the exact same thing that I did to Stu, but I don't mean it offensively. I don't have kids. I do have a cat. So that's the nearest thing I can think of. For me, I care more about her behaviour than my flatmate does.
100%.
So that is a thing that I have ownership of. And I lead on how much the cat is allowed to get away with, because that's the thing that's going to upset me more, whereas she cares less.
100%.
Yeah. So this is why I think I can relate to you very well. So before we relate to each other further, I would like to hear your dating story.
So I'm going to give you, because we were talking about arranged marriage, I'm going to give you the story of the last boy I was introduced to for marriage. It was a date, because by that time, my mother had been trying for 8 years. She started when I was very early. I was 18 when she started introducing me to boys, because she thought, you know, she'll finish college. And my mother used to say to me, you are a duffer, because I wasn't very academic. I got good grades, but I didn't really care. So she would say, you are a duffer. You have to marry early and have the children early and become of some use. So anyway, it's like, okay. And I was like, okay, fine. Yeah, fine. Because I wanted to have kids and I wanted to be a housewife, I think. This was like a date for the following reasons. I had finished studying in the UK, so I was studying in North America. And my mother had found out about this boy from friends of friends. And it was a date in that my mother had finally managed to make we call it biodata in India, it's like a CV. The CV of the boys had to match my goals, which were I wanted to be an academic. And because I had chosen to do a PhD in philosophy, the likelihood of me getting a job anywhere outside of the Western world was zero. So I was going to live in the West, probably. So she'd found a boy. He was academic and a doctor, and he was living in North America. So she'd really made it like a blind date, you know? And he didn't mind if his wife worked after, you know, and he was quite excited to have the prospect of a wife who was also an academic. So it was like a date. So what happened was he flew to where I lived and I'd never met him. We'd spoken on the phone briefly. He was older than me by maybe 4 or 5 years. We met for dinner and it was fine. This is not the date, but I just wanted to set this up. We met for dinner and we were supposed to meet again for lunch. He was there for 2.5 days, but I was uncomfortable enough that the next day when we met, and that's the date I want to talk to you about, it was actually dinner again. I decided to bring 2 girlfriends unannounced with me. So from the guy's point of view, he's talking to me to potentially talk about getting married. I pitch up with 2 friends. One is Canadian and one is a friend I know from India. The friend I know from India I was very close to and still am. She's a little eccentric. And she's a scientist, so she would run all these experiments on herself without telling us. So once she ran an experiment where she just drank water and smoked red Marlboros, that's all she did. And she wanted to see how she would feel after 3 days.
I feel I could have told her that, but okay. What did she find out?
But she would like take notes. I don't know, because she passed out. That's how we knew. Oh, God. We were all sitting for a test and she fell out of her chair. And I was like, are you dead? She was like, I've only had water and red Marlboros. We were like, what? Anyway, she was going through this thing. So we didn't know that she was running another experiment, which involved weed. She'd been growing it in her room. I didn't know that. I asked her to come. And then the other friend I had was very, very feminist, which she was a very dear friend of mine as well at the time. So I said to them, you've got to come. And they said, why? And I said, just come. And I said to my Indian friend, sort of in Hindi, so the other friend couldn't hear, that this is a boy for marriage. Because my feminist Western friend would have been like, that's unconscionable or whatever the word is, because she took all arranged marriages to be slightly forced. When we got to the thing, I said to her, I turned to her, and we'll just call her Susan. I said, Susan, this is for marriage. She was like, what the? I was like, just don't freak out. He's very nice. She said, then why are we here? And I'm like, because I don't kind of feel that safe with him. She's like, that is a red flag. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but I got to get married. And he's got a great job. And he's the right, like the right family for my parents and blah, blah, blah. He was also like a half inch shorter than me, which bothered me a bit. And my mother had lied about that, which I had confronted her with and said, he's not 6'1", ma. I think he's 5'9½". She said, oh, 9½, 1'6". Who cares? He's a lovely boy. I'm like, what? So, but he was already there. So we sit down. He's a little surprised, but he doesn't say anything. And we just start, you know, shooting the breeze. I used to be a big smoker. So I said, oh, I'm going to smoke. Do you mind? Which was a huge thing as an Indian woman to pull out a cigarette in the middle of an arranged marriage scenario. And he was like, oh, no, I don't mind. But if you're going to smoke, I'm going to drink. And I thought, what do you mean? But if I'm going to smoke, you're going to drink. It just seemed weird to me. As soon as he said that, Susan squeezed my hand like this under the table, like red flag. And I was like, now, the way this date got very weird was the following. As the evening wore on, this guy clearly in many ways presented the fact that he was highly unsuitable, okay? Highly. But that he sort of couldn't believe his luck that he was in this situation and that, look, I don't want to say anything public. He was highly unsuitable. So he kept saying things. He kept taking up the inappropriateness of his conversation up a notch. Susan started freaking out. So what she started doing is kicking me under the table every time. So it'd be like, whack, whack. What she didn't realize is she was kicking my Indian friend who was getting increasingly high on whatever she'd been taking before she came out with us that we didn't know she'd been taking. And my Indian friend, of course, assumed that this lascivious man was kicking her under the table. At some point, my Indian friend exploded out of her chair, looked at this guy and said, you just stop it, man. Just fuck it. Fuck you. Stop it. And we were like, oh. And we did. And he was like, oh. No one knew what was going on. She said, just stop it. Kick me one more time. I'll box your face. And he said, but I haven't kicked you. And my friend Susan was like, because she'd been kicking me. And I was like, well, who's kicking who? And he decided to bring the whole tone back by telling a very dirty, dirty story about a dog and a woman that was so inappropriate and so bad that I was like, you know what? Let's just get the bill. Oh, this has been fun. I got a fever the next day. That's how stressed out I was by this. And then, of course, I said no to my mom. But It was a ridiculous date because it was very Fawlty Towers in terms of who's kicking who. This guy was wildly inappropriate. And I was thinking, I kept thinking to myself, yeah, but maybe if I spoke to him about it, you know, he would still be a good husband. Like I was had La La Land in my head about this guy. And if one friend hadn't kicked the wrong person, the other friend wouldn't have jumped up and made it clear to me by saying, fuck it, you fucking, I box you fucking, or whatever she was saying. It wouldn't have like broken me out of my reverie. And then he told this terrible story. And I was like, this is all bets are off. So really that was the date. I don't know if it's as funny in the telling as it was at the time. It wasn't funny at all, but it was outrageous what was going on. And also we found out about my friend doing the weed experiment.
Yeah, this, I think it's hilarious. I could just see it all playing out. And it's interesting because it follows a bit of a trend that I see with a lot of my female guests, where a lot of these dating stories start off with, I wasn't sure about this guy, or, you know, I thought maybe I shouldn't go on another date with them, or I met them in a weird, like all these situations where women go in trying to give the benefit of the doubt and then being disappointed.
Yeah, and for marriage. I just want to point, this was
those
for marriage.
States as well. And this is the thing that I find really fascinating about the Indian matchmaking kind of system, right? Because on one hand, you can look at it as an outsider and think this kind of pressure to marry young, and if you don't marry quickly enough, there's something wrong with you. You can think that seems quite extreme. But the problem is, because the arranged marriages are so widespread, the system kind of perpetuates that becoming true.
Oh, yeah.
Because if all of you have the same kind of pressure going on, then it does become the one that doesn't get married off young. It's not for lack of trying. And so,
no,
you know, I can see that he came into this and was like, this is this incredible woman. I've really landed on my feet here, and maybe felt comfortable enough to show all the bad sides of himself that probably ruled him out from all the other people he'd been introduced to.
And to think the whole time I was like, well, maybe if I spoke to him or whatever, because he was such a, as my mother said, he's sketch, just get him. That's why he's called a catch. I'm like, that's not why he's called a catch. I'm not going to catch him. The guy's a perv. Forget it. So my mother, I remember, said, what is perv? Oh, pervert. Very bad, very bad. Perverts are very bad. I'm like, yeah, they are very bad, mommy. But if my friend hadn't had this kind of slightly drug-induced freak out, he wouldn't have told the worst story, and I probably would have seen him again, but I didn't. He was in town from across the continent the whole of the next day, and I was like, no, I don't feel well.
Wow.
Yeah, that was high stakes. And he was the last one. After that, I said to my mother, it's not going to work. I don't think so. And so she was so sad. She cried and cried and said, oh, I but I didn't find that I'd want. I said, no, I don't think I'm going to marry. And I didn't want to lead anyone on, you know. Plus, I was dating on the side, but she didn't know that, because I was dating Western men who I was like, I'm not going to marry them because they have a whole different expectation matrix. But then I ended up marrying a Westerner because I sort of changed all of those ideas when I turned 27. Mm. I decided to change. I said, I've been through this thing and it's not how it works. I'm just, you know. The thing is, I was made for marriage. Like, I tried to enter this massive slut phase and it didn't get very far, did it? I fucking got married. I was like, God damn it. I was just trying to have some meaningless sex.
How dare a nice guy come along, interrupt your whole plan.
I know, my slut phase.
I think that's a big
part
of it.
By the way, which I mean in a good way. I mean that in a very good way. Of all the phases I've been through, my fondest memories are of my short but exciting slut phase.
But I think a big part of it that's fascinating is the expectations, because they can be so different, but they're kind of unrealistic on either side. Because if you're watching Bollywood and you see, you know, the things that it portrays, that you meet the right guy and then you break out into a synchronized dance in the street and everybody knows the moves, that's no more realistic than, you know, Disney is and the stuff that we grow up on more here.
Absolutely.
Of you meet the right prince and, you know, with the right woman, he can become the king he's meant to be. It's all myth that we're sold.
Yeah.
But because it's sold to us so well, of course we want it.
Except, well, I think for me, the actual wedding was not a thing. That was for my parents. And my husband proposed. I think for me, it was like you find the person and then just do it. Just get married in a registry. Because that's like a legal thing, you know, then it makes life easier. But the wedding and all, But obviously my husband, he proposed, I said yes. And then all the parents were like, we want to do the wedding. We want to do the wedding. So we're like, fine. So we did one in India, one in Denmark. The one we did here was we both left work and signed the register. But I mean, I always wanted to be, I suppose, married in the sense of make a home with someone, a life with someone. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to have kids. So I had this idea that if I didn't meet the right person, I would get IVF. So I had to financially secure myself for that. And I think that's also what gave me a lot of interest in my career as a banker. Because you could put money away when you're a banker.
Indeed.
And you would need that if you were going to raise kids and have IVF. And I told my mother, she was so offended. Where will sperm come from? Who is putting the sperm? And I was like, first of all, stop shouting sperm in my face. And second of all, I said, you can pick. She said, oh, you cannot take the karmic liability of other person. And I was like, oh, God. But it never came to all that.
I love, but then I was listening to Nicole Byer's podcast the other day, and one of her guests was talking about growing up around a culture of arranged marriages. And he was saying that there can be a lot of criticism of it, but he just looks at it having come from that background and thinks, well, people are more comfortable in many places being matched by an algorithm than they are a family member or a family friend introducing them to somebody. Like, that seems like they would be more in your best interest.
Yeah, no. I'm a big, for the record, I'm a huge fan of arranged marriages. And I hope to be able to nudge my children in the direction of a person they end up with. Nudge, because I can't arrange their marriage. They'll go crazy if I even suggest it. I'm not going to make it my life work like my mother, because obviously the compunctions of Indian parents in that generation was to marry your daughter or your son off. It's a duty. You know, I don't have that. But if I came across someone at the right time and my kids when they're older, I would very strongly probably orchestrate a situation in which they should meet them. My husband would very strongly lock me in a room and not let me do it. But I don't see that's not an arranged marriage in the sense it's an arranged meeting, because matchmakers have existed in human society since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. And right now, anyone who says, well, matchmakers, Tinder is a matchmaker, frankly. So what's the big deal? Exactly like your other guy was saying. But also, just for the record, and I'm happy to put it out there, I totally am a big fan of, you know, looking at our friends and looking at our wider circle when all the kids are grown up and thinking,
Right, because these definitions are actually pretty flexible. You know, if a friend of mine set me up on a blind date and I went on to marry that person, you might describe that as an assisted marriage.
Yeah, and I mean, what's the problem? What is, because you know what? I think there is a obsession, and it's predicated on fear, in the idea that there is something simultaneously random but meant to be when we meet our soulmate. It's not that fucking complicated, man. It's not such a mystery. You like the people you like, and whether you meet them because your mother opens the door to them or you open the door to them, how the fuck does it matter?
Yeah. And this speaks
to, how does it matter?
I think, the kind of weird binary we can have, that if you're in a marriage, good, if you're not, bad. And I care so much more about the quality of the relationship. Like, that's where the real work is, right?
Well, that's what I told you. You know, you wake up and you mark to market and say, if this thing isn't working, I'm out. I'm not going to stay married for the sake of staying married. God damn it. I want to liberate the other person as well. Because let me tell you, if one of you in a marriage is unhappy, both of you are going to be unhappy. You know, and so deal with your own shit. Why are you making someone else unhappy? Get out. And I have to say, it's not a romantic notion to say that, you know, I've always had this thing that when you get married, you should never, ever, ever fear being unmarried if it's not working. But what it does when you take the shame and the fear out of that notion, you then look at compromise very differently. Mm-hmm. You see, you start looking at what really is not working. When you say this marriage is not working, what is the content of that phrase not working? You start to really look at that, because you can always leave. No one's stopping you. A lot of people like to dance behind the, oh, but you know, I couldn't really think about divorce. I couldn't really think about leaving. So they stay in the dance. They don't really look at, what is it that I think of as a non-working marriage?
Yeah.
Because Indians, we are raised to stay married. Yeah. We have a much more elastic idea of what a marriage not working looks like. My mother used to say to me, she had old-fashioned ideas, as you know. And I used to want, you know, I would complain to her about my marriage and say, oh, you know, I don't know. And this is not working. She'd say, your husband is like a gem. He's a diamond. Such a good boy. He doesn't beat you. He doesn't take all your money. And he doesn't say you are a fat and stupid, ugly bitch. And I was like, but that's not the bar. And she would say, but one day husband will come and you'll be complaining about him. And he will say, oh, look at this head, bitch. I better get a number two. Then he will get a girlfriend. And I was like, you know, you're crazy, man. But, you know, that was her bar. Obviously, from her background, very feudal, you know, not very feminist. She was very feminist, but the world she came from. But I have to agree with my mom is that what is your bar? Not just your bar. What do you think a working marriage should feel like all the time? That's the freedom you get to explore what that notion means. Once you say, if it doesn't work, I'll leave.
Yes. And I do find that particularly funny because what I understand about your mum, she's probably called you a good 50% of those things. So it's maybe in comparison to her, he seems lovely. Well,
She could, because I have a temper. She couldn't believe it. She used to say, you shouting and having fights and having the cigarettes and this boy, he doesn't spit on your face too. He still loves you. She asked me a very sweet question once. My mother had been married about 10 years. She said, let me ask you this. She said, when I see you and your husband, and I understand what Westerners mean when they say in love, but what does it feel like to be in love? And I thought that was such a sweet question. I was explaining to her and she was saying, well, but that's love. What is in love? And I said, oh, Ma, I said, the in love stuff is in the beginning when you're like really hot for the person. She said, oh, it's the private matters. I was like, yeah, I guess so. She said, all the kissing and all those things. I said, yes. And then she said, but then it just becomes love. I said, yeah. She said, but that's why they divorce. She said, isiliye to divorce karte hain. They're always looking for in love. That will finish. Then in love will become wife out. Love in, wife out. I was like, put that on a cup and let's sell that. But she had a point, you know. She sort of was, I guess, saying to me that if you are always going to go for that magic of romance, your marriage is not going to feel great.
Yes, put it on a mug. I like that. And I actually want to give you, your mum can get some points for that, but I want to give you some points for something you said earlier, where you were talking about unpicking the fear of the relationship breaking down and how it puts you in a more reasoned headspace, which I think is so true because, you know, I always try and look at these things from both sides. And I think, would I ever want to be with somebody where they're staying with me because they fear the alternative? No, I want them to be with me because they want to be with me, right? And I think you looking at it in that way and trying to unpick some of that fear helps you to be more rational because you're not acting from a place of the fear and the strong emotion. You're looking at it more objectively and how can I compromise? And I'm winning most things. Maybe I can chuck him a few bones.
Yes. And I think rational, I would say reasonable. I always worry about the word rational because I'm so irrational at the best of times. But I think reasonable. I think also one thing that we tend to sometimes maybe lose sight of is no matter whether you're in a relationship or not, even if you're in a long-term relationship, ultimately you're leading your life by yourself. The life you lead is in your head. That is the starting point. So you can be lonely in a marriage. You can be lonely in a relationship because it's your relationship with you that really is the life you're leading. So long-term in a marriage, you've got to think, do I want to keep company with this person when nothing about them and me is necessarily fueling my joy, but I have my life, they have their life, and we kind of just meet up and say, hey man, how's it going? I'll make you a cup of tea, fine. If you're able to weather that without the relationship having to work so hard to make you feel good about everything's going on, then I think you have a hope of staying long-term with someone because Jesus, relationships mean, fuck, we put so much pressure on them. You know, I had a shitty day. My kid's not listening to me. My hair is falling out. I'm eating so much ice cream. I've got three asses now instead of one. But when I look at my partner, somehow we should have amazing sex and they should look at me in a way that makes me feel like it's all okay. What are we talking about? That's not how it goes. It's more, what has this person done for me and what have I done for them that we can share a cup of coffee and sort of feel like lockdown sucks donkey's dick, but that's it. And I, you know, the biggest thing is that I'll say something and he'll make me laugh.
Yeah.
And I think that's where love resides after a point.
And I like that kind of, it becomes a teammate mentality, right? That you become a team and you're taking on the world. And some together. Issues you deal with individually and some issues you need the backup of someone else, as opposed to them and the relationship being an antidote for the world, that the world is tough and they're going to save you from it. You know, I think that's absolutely. The way you can live in a bubble, and that's not necessarily helpful.
Absolutely. And I think watching my parents' marriage and my mother, who I'll give an example. I never cooked because my mother cooked, and she cooked for my father, and what the times that he ate was so important. And she didn't want to go into the kitchen, but she would go. She made a big song and dance about it all the time. And I thought, I'm never doing that for a man. I'm never going to cook. But then in lockdown, I started cooking, and I realized that my mother cooked to connect with her love for my dad. So, because she used to say to me, you know, I hate your father so much. You know that. So anyway, then I was like, it was like she constantly would say this. And we were like, why are you? Because I don't want you to think I love him. I hate him. And then blah, 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 blah. And my father just absolutely adored my mom, but was quite a patriot. You know, he was a bit of a patriarch, but he adored my mom. He would say to us, oh, I adore your mother. She's so great. My mother, like, I hate him. And we'd be like, what the fuck is going on in this marriage? But what I realized is that if you can find where your love for your long-term partner lives and connect to that, it makes you extraordinary, you see? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that you become very strong, you become a good partner, you feel happy, you think, I'm a good partner in this marriage, because you've connected with where your love for that partner lives, and you dip in and out of that. We so often think that loving a person is about them. And that's also why I always have this thing of, if it doesn't work, I'm out. Because if I can't find that in me, or if I'm not able to generate for that person, it's very unfair. Then you say to them, come on, you make it work. No, I have to find that love for them. Of course, it's based on who they are and how they are. But some people can be nice and nice and nice, and their partner's a dick because they won't allow, you know, they won't accept. They won't make it their business to be a good partner. And I'm going to tell you a story which I've never really talked about, which I hope I can get through without crying. But it really made this thing clear to me. So my mother had a stroke in January 2019. It was unexpected. You know, I'm very close to my mom. So mm-hmm. It was very traumatic. And anyway, I rushed to India and my tour was starting and I didn't know what to do. And anyway, she was in the hospital with a stroke and was paralyzed. Half of her was paralyzed. And she was such a vital woman. And there she was. And we didn't know if she would talk again, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she spoke again, but only through one side of her face, which I do a great impression of. But I won't, because it's a bit weird and this is a podcast. But anyway, my cousins would come to hospital and be like, oh my God, you do an amazing impression of her. I'm like, I know. And I even showed her, I'm like, this is how you look now. And I would talk through the left side of my face.
I think people are going to want to hear it now. You've hyped it up so much.
She used to laugh through the side of her face. She'd be like, and we would laugh together. Because mommy, if there's one thing she taught us, it was laugh through everything. Because otherwise, what's your fucking choice? What's the alternative? 3 months after my mother had her stroke, she was fed with a tube through her nose and she hated it. And the only thing she used to say to me is, can I have a coffee? Can I have a coffee? And I used to say, Ma, I can't. And she used to give me ideas. She used to say, you know, at night, just give me a little bit of coffee. And I'd be like, Ma, they don't know if your throat is working. So I can't. What if you choke? She said, at least I'll die on coffee. I love coffee. I said, no, Ma, I'm not going to stay in the hospital at night and kill you with coffee. She said, you don't never do anything for your mother, such a useless daughter. Anyway, 3 months in, they decided that they were going to test whether her throat muscles could move. So they squeezed some fresh juice, and it was fresh pomegranate, which is at that time was in season in Coimbatore in South India, where my mother was. And my dad was running around doing admin. We had a big hotel, we had a big hospital room and then a living room because it was like a long-term stay ward. And I stood by while the nurses made the juice and they said to me, you can give her a few drops. So I said, Ma, are you ready? And she said, is it coffee? And I said, no. She said, fuck this. And I was like, don't say that. Don't say it. The nurses are scared. What are you doing? You got to try this. And she said, I fuck it. I said, you don't fuck it. Just do the thing. I said, I promise you, you'll like it. She was so funny. She said, nahi chahiye mujhe ye bhencho. She said, I don't want this sister fucking drink. I'm like, there's no need. Because in India, instead of motherfucker, you say sister fucker a lot. She said, I don't want this sister fucking drink. I'm like, just taste it. So I put a few drops of it on her. And she was from the, like, she was a farmer. She was a land-owning family she came from. So she knew fruits and vegetables and fresh and what soil. And so I gave her a few drops of this juice and she tasted it. And she said, anar ka juice, it's pomegranate. And remember, this woman had not tasted anything for 3.5 months. I said, yeah, it is. And then she said, it's fresh pomegranate because they must be in season. is it the spring? I said, it is, Ma, it's March. And she said, oh, she said, it's fresh. It's a very good quality pomegranate. I said, yeah. And then she said, take the cup and make sure your father has some.
Oh.
And I thought to myself, God damn, her love for my father always resided in making sure that he ate well and the freshest of fruit was there for him. And her first reaction after tasting something was, make sure your father has it. And this is the father she said, you know, I hate your father. And I think that's in that moment, I thought, you know, my generation or us or modern people, you know, we think love resides in endless compliments and great sex and, you know, do you know me? Do you hear me? All those things. And I don't think my mother got a lot of that, but she was so connected to her love for my father. It made her such a robust creature. And I think long-term, and they were married almost 60 years. I think I see that as an inspiration. I think I want to stay connected with whatever I think my love for my spouse is, because it makes me a more robust creature. And isn't that how we all want to live?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing it. I think your mom has given us your rule of the game right there, that maybe true love isn't about two wonderful people. It's about two wonderfully loving people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about two wonderfully loving people who really, it's about two people who believe in love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's such a lovely story. And, you know, the context can be so different. You know, your mum came from such a different upbringing even than you did, one generation further.
My God.
And yet, you know, it wasn't the upbringing and the context that made the difference. It was what she did with it, where she fit within that structure.
Also, how much my mother wanted to be happy.
Yeah.
That was my mother's aim in life. She used to say, I want to be in constant self-delight. Like, that doesn't even make sense. She said, I want to be in a state of constant self-delight.
I love that. And, you know, that's the thing. And that's why I kind of like strong-willed people, because so often, you know, even though there are things that they might say that can seem harsh, it's so clear that your mum had your best interests in heart.
Oh, 100%. And I will never begrudge two things. The stuff that mummy did that was very tough, and I confronted her, she apologized for some of it. Oh, that was horrible when I said that. I did say you were the world's most ugly child. I'm sorry. I was like, oh God. She apologized and she would give me backstory. She would say, you know, I was very upset by this, or, and it wasn't a, she didn't say it so that I would forgive her. She said it because to make it clear that it was completely outside of what she would have wanted to have said had she had any control over how she was feeling, or was, you know, she went through a hard time with a lot of different things. So once your parent says, I'm sorry, I really fucked up, it's very liberating. So that's one thing she did. And the other thing she did is she always had my best interest. My mother would have hidden a dead body for me if I killed someone, for sure. And that is the level of loyalty, I think.
And I think that's the perfect illustration of it, that sometimes people are so kind and so caring that things are very personal for them, and then they need the kind of release. You know, that she would absolutely do it for you, but you would hear rants about it for the rest of your life to kind of counterbalance
forever.
It.
Forever. She'd be like, you know how it felt, the stinky dead body in the next room? I had to hide from police. But she would have hid it. But she would have given me a lot of hard time about it. And she would have made it very funny. There's so many things like that, my God. But I think for me, in my life, and it's not my mom's life, I just want to be clear, I'm not at a place where I think, oh, it doesn't matter about, you know, romance and sex and this and that. I think it does. But I, even as I obsess about those things, there's a voice in my head that says, this is not the be all and end all. So, you know, keep some balance. Even that awareness makes me.
It's an ingredient. It's not the whole thing. You know, because often we forget the stuff that seems kind of boring. You know, that stuff is exciting. What's also important for a long-term relationship? Routine. How enjoyable your commute is. Do you like your job? Like the stuff that's less fun to chase after.
The outside stuff, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, have you stayed awake, you know, all night for 5 years because you've got little kids?
Yeah, and that is so important. God. And particularly in a lockdown, your routine has such a big influence on everything.
Yeah.
And yet it's kind of boring to sort your routine out, but we need to do it. And to wrap up then with my rule of the game, I think a takeaway from this conversation is that it's so much more important the quality of the relationships and the interactions than it ever is the way in which you meet. You know, that is only the first step.
Oh, my God. That is exactly. You know, when you walk into any room, a party, a restaurant, any room where you feel joy, you never think about what did the door look like.
Mm.
Never. You know, was it a blue door? Was it a wooden door? Did it have? No, you just see it in the room.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. I love your rule. I think it's so true.
And it's partly informed by me being a person that spent a lot of my younger life on public transport, fancying people on buses. So that's a less serious side of it where I'm like, I clearly don't care. I don't care if I like trip and someone helps me up and then that's my person. I would much rather that embarrassing situation than, you know, not meet somebody that's potentially great.
Oh my God. Oh my God. If one of our friends hadn't got married out of nowhere within the first 3-4 weeks of being at a new university where we were all new, within the first term, and I hadn't been so angry that I'd been dumped by a boy that my mother thought, even though he was a Westerner, she thought I should marry him because he's a doctor, that I hadn't asked this new Scandinavian guy who'd showed up in the group for as an exchange student to be my date because I didn't want to go on this thing alone, I would never be married.
Wow.
Like, it was not a big role. It was like completely weird how we ended up even having a conversation. It was just, yeah.
Yeah, you're available. Yeah. Come with me.
Yeah, I was like you. Because everyone else, I was like you. And he just looked at me, didn't say anything. He was eating an apple. I'm like, you're my date. Wear something that matches pink and orange.
And he's been following your rules ever since.
No, and he was like, okay. And then it was so funny because he's a very strong-minded person. And I came down a half an hour late, which for a Dane is unheard of. And he said, oh, there you are. I thought you died.
And you probably thought, this is a familiar humor. That's the kind of thing my mom would say.
Yeah, I was like, what is this? I've heard this before. So no, and here we are. That was 26 years ago. Jesus.
All right, well, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much. If people want to find you online, you're Sindhu V Funny on Twitter. The show that I mentioned, Sandhog, which is really incredible, you still tour. It's just doing so well. One day, I hope it will be recorded and I'll get to watch it back. But
well,
yeah.
I'm doing some shows for that at Soho Theatre, and that'll come out later, because I will be doing a recording of that. So we're trying to work up for that. So yeah, so keep, stay tuned. Go to my website, people, sindhuv.com, and there'll be information on that, because Sandhog will be, I will do it a few more times. And on Instagram, I'm SindhuV, because I never matched up the different names. I was like, oh, blah. So Twitter, I'm something else. Instagram, I'm something else. But anyway, you can find me. How many SindhuVs are there, please? That's what Google is for.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more content, including extended ad-free episodes, you can join our Patreon, linked in the episode description. Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta, with music by the brilliant Tessa Violet. Speak to you next Friday.